around it to increase the surface area because you need light activation. So you can't just use a spongy material, because if you use the spongy material, you can soak up the hydrogen, but you can't release the hydrogen because the laser will never strike a good portion of that solid spongy material. So that's how they came up with the tape concept. And the way to get the greatest surface area would be to use a tape cassette-like technology that everyone's familiar with if they ever had a cassette tape machine. So that's my little two cents of it. Again, interesting concept, might be very useful, might not. Would love to see them to do more work on it and publish the results.
You know, I.D., you talk too much. Let me tell you something.
Repeater, timeout, cancel.
Mercy call, go ahead. KC2FFA.
Okay, Charlie, I don't know if you told me that I talk too much. I did time out the machine, so maybe I do talk too much. If you talk while the machine's timed out, then nothing happens either. So I'm sorry for that, but I was trying to kind of sum up what was going on here.
Thank you for that. Thank you for that. Yeah, it's interesting what you said. We compare it to the technology where the Japanese Toyota Mriya uses hydrogen tanks at 600 bars. It's 10,000 PCI. We need also remember that some properties of hydrogen, the hydrogen starts boiling. Boiling in minus 252.8 Celsius, which would be 423 Fahrenheit, minus. And if you want to keep it in liquid phase, you need to cool it down and chuck it into a cryogenic tank, which is expensive to maintain. Now, with the technology that is proposed by Plasma Kinetic, you don't need any temperatures, you need any pressure, you just I take the tape and use the tape. What I like the most is that I spend more than 5 minutes on the gas station, and they promise that I will have lower refueling time compared to the batteries, and it takes only 5 minutes. So that's a good one for that. Anyhow, I think we beat all of the bushes on that subject. Interesting situation. If it work, and guys, $32 for 1,000 miles, it's a good price. We have a hydrogen for $16.59, I believe, so close to $17. Per kilogram of hydrogen. Toyota Mriya needs five kilograms of hydrogen to go 1,000 miles. But then we sitting on high pressure hydrogen tank, and we won't need that if we use the technology of plasma kinetics. Thank you. And to Xia.
ACTPL.
Yes, Jeff.
How you doing, Roy? AC2PL Jeff over here in Westchester County. Number one, I don't think anyone should speak out against Dr. Roy like that. That was really rude. I don't think that should be said or done on this net. Number two, this is the third week in a row we've heard about hydrogen running cars, and I still have the same argument against it. I think it's an immature technology. I think it's naive to even begin to believe that it's going to operate the way we've been led to believe. It might work, and it's not coming this year or next year. So I think we should listen to Dr. Roy. AC2PL.
Thank you for your comment, and I agree with you. It was a third discussion about hydrogen just because we get to the new information about that we didn't discuss, but I don't believe that I have any news in this area. One thing that Dr. Roy told me that it was a time when the battery-powered vehicles were discussed, and he had a news almost every day for it. Dr. Roy.
Well, yeah, I mean, battery technology is a great limitation. So many things could kind of take off if batteries had the exponential growth that Moore's law has with the semiconductor devices. But that batteries are chemistry, and chemistry hasn't been revolutionized lately. Energy density of things like lithium have improved battery capability, but not by the exponential growth of solid-state physics and such. So, you know, what would be great is if we had super batteries, and people are working on, quote, super batteries every day and issuing public releases from their marketing departments, usually something about graphene. And I like to read them, but again, I'm not going to invest my money in them because most of them don't pan out. So I thank everyone for their comments, and I thank Phil, Jeff, for supporting me. Charlie, if you're still out there and you want to ask the actual antenna question, you can if you want. Okay, I will take that as a no. So thank you, Wesley. Thank you, Jeff. Thanks, everyone who participated in our little chat about hydrogen. Hopefully we can kind of retire hydrogen for the time being, unless or until something really revolutionary happens. I'm sure we'll come up with all kinds of other interesting topics to talk about. So once again, I am AC2GS. My name is Roy, and this is the Limark Technical Net. It's been going on for about 39 and a half years. I really should find out exactly when it began so we can do something special for our 40th year anniversary. But until that point, if anyone else out there has any questions of a technical nature, any kind of science relation, even medicine, as long as it's not specific, feel free, hit that push-to-talk button, give me your first name and your call sign.
KD2VHD.
Yes, Jim.
Roy, it was wonderful to meet you today. Nice to put a face to the voice. I just wanted to make a comment that as much as I enjoy everybody's input into what goes on the net that you do, I don't think Roy, I don't think Wesley's input is benign. I'll just leave it at that.
Okay, Jim. Everyone's free to have an opinion. Wesley is legitimately enthusiastic about these technologies and wants to talk about it. And as I mentioned before, we kind of opened up the technical net. I would really like to talk about amateur radio stuff, but apparently people don't have that much amateur radio stuff to talk about, or they figured it out themselves and they don't need anyone's help. So we kind of broaden the scope of the technical net. And everyone has a chance. Everyone with a radio or even with an email account can pose a question here on the technical net. I await any future questions from anyone out there. So, you know, this isn't the kind of lockdown type of situation. If you would rather hear topics of a different nature, I would suggest people ask questions or make comments about those other aspects, and we can spend time discussing them as well. I have nothing against that.
Totally agree. So how do I fit an antenna for 160 meters on just short of that amount of length of land? Any ideas?
Well, yeah. I mean, you can do a quick and dirty solution with a antenna tuner or an impedance transforming device, or simply loading coils in the design of the antenna to electronically tune it for a longer length than it is mechanically. So that there are a number of ways. You will increase the Q which means that you'll decrease the resonant frequency bandwidth. So you may have to adjust the resonance for the portion of 160 meters that you prefer. You know, if you're into phone, you would tend to prefer it to be resonant at the phone portion. If you were interested in CW or FT8 or such, you would kind of tune it for the lower frequency where data modes are kept.
I was hoping for the phone modes, but I'm right at the verge of being able to fit it. So it's right, it fits, but it don't fit. So I don't know. I'm looking for some help.
Okay, like I said, antennas do not have to be inherently mechanical resonant. They can be electronically resonant, and that just requires insertion of some kind of a passive circuit that adjusts the mild capacitance that a shortened non-resonant antenna possesses. You do get a little bit of a hit for it, as I mentioned before, but better a little hit than a large standing wave ratio, reflections, and all kinds of things. So, again, you can either do a few loading coils on the antenna itself. You can do some form of impedance adjustment at the feed point, or you can run open line so it's lossless to your shack and run it into an antenna tuner, and then adjust the impedance accordingly for 50 ohms, in which you should get a decent 160-meter operation.
Well, that certainly clarifies everything.
Well, good. That's hopefully the point of this technical deck.
It's a good day. Good hearing you.
Likewise, and I appreciate your presence and your participation in this technical net. Once again, this is still AC2GS, and my name is still Roy, and this is still the Limark technical net. And, you know, I would like to get the questions and such keep going for a half hour, if at all possible. If you want me to read Science Talk articles, we could do that, or we could discuss the topics on the Science Talk articles. I would, again, remind people that I mentioned earlier, in case you weren't noticing, Roy's Links, which is found at roy.ac2gs.com. It's a link of interesting articles, interesting YouTubes, and one of them is Veritasium. Dick, K2RIW, was another big fan of this guy. He's a PhD in physics. He has wonderfully produced material. And this past week, he put out a wonderful video on the history of imaginary numbers and the complex number line. So we use it every time we use a lot of our electronic equations, a lot of electrical engineering method involves imaginary exponential numbers. So, complex numbers. When we talk about impedance, we're talking about complex numbers. Instead of the imaginary number being I times something, we use J because electrical engineers were tired of seeing I crop up because we use I for a whole bunch of different things in electrical engineering. So the imaginary component of a complex number, the reactance of the part of the impedance, is written as J times a certain number of ohms. But it's a fascinating video, and I do urge you people to take a look at it. You know, even if you don't understand it, and I think many of you will understand it better when you see the way he describes it. He is not overly complex and shows a lot of very nice pictures. So avail yourself of it. But nevertheless, if anyone out there has any actual questions or comments or topics they would like to discuss, please hit that push-to-talk button, give me your first name and your call sign.
Kitty 2, UAH, name is Rocco Roy.
Yes, Rocco, I'm glad you're around. I'm sorry that we missed you last week. Do you have a question for us tonight?
Yeah, I actually have a couple of questions, but I'll just ask one. It's not the one I was going to ask last week. I'll do that next week. But, you know, we've been talking about some HF work, and, you know, I haven't done much myself. But my question is going in the other direction. I've gotten some interest in the 1200 band, and I know that we have a repeater. I'm going to let it drop. So I understand that we have a repeater now that works on the 1200 band, and there's not much radio equipment available, and I don't know if I want to buy a 9700 for $1,500, and I know that it's about $250 made by, I'm trying to think of the company now, Elinco, will do, but at only 1 watt. I know the max is 10 watts. Is there anything really much to listen to? I'll let it drop. Is there much activity on the 1200 band? Is it worth getting into the 1200 band? I know we have a repeater, but is anybody really on it? So I'd just like maybe some comment and maybe a little guidance in the direction before I make the plunge. The SUHF band intrigues me, but I don't know that anybody's going to really be on it, and maybe some satellite work. So just some comments on that and what you think about that band.
Okay, very good. Well, I personally have not had any experience with it. I have spoken with Andy, and perhaps Andy is listening in the background and can add some additions because he set up the 1.2 gig repeater back in its site, so it's functional. I got the sense from him that it's not very active. Understandably, I don't think 1.2 gigs is particularly active most of the time, and since our repeater was down for a considerable portion of time, and it takes time for people to realize that repeaters are back up and working, there can be that factor as well. I think if for whatever reason you want another band in the VHF, UHF, etc., region, you might benefit a little bit more from 220. Not that it gets a lot of activity, but probably a significantly more activity than 1.2. So I have no experience with 1.2. Just from talking to people, I don't get a sense that it's a particularly active band. Could be wrong, but if there are people out there with more experience and have used it and tried it and have opinions, please feel free to hit that push-to-talk button.
I want to just tell you, I have actually gained a lot of experience with the 220 band. I got into it kind of heavily in the last year, and I have a few 220 radios. And, for example, there's that Gara network that goes up and down the coast. You can hit the repeater in, Syosset, either on 2 meters, they have a 440, and they have the 220. So I access it on the 220, and I can talk to the guys on 2 meter. And the 220 has a much lower noise floor, and I can hit that repeater from a greater distance with the 220 radio. I'm really hot on 220 and sold on it. And I'm talking to guys in Buffalo and Canada on 220. They're on their 2 meter rigs. So 220 is a great band on Long Island. And a lot of people really overlook it. It's too bad.
Yeah, it's unfortunate. There's nothing inherently wrong with it. I think, unfortunately, repeater use in general is down. One of the biggest things that new amateur radio operators talk to me about is they buy themselves a Baofeng, they open up a repeater list, and they keep pushing buttons, and they don't hear anyone, and they wonder if it's them or the repeaters or something else. Generally speaking, this repeater is one of the more active repeaters in the metropolitan area, but it's shut down from midnight to 6 a.m., and there are hours where it's dead quiet, and that's an active repeater. There are other repeaters on 2 meters that you can barely hear. They ID themselves, and that's about it. So I'm glad that you're getting use out of 220. There's nothing wrong with 220. It's a perfectly useful frequency. There's a lot of radios out there that are built as tri-banders capable of utilizing them. I believe Sam just at the beginning of this technical net was talking about a Yaesu radio, which is a quad band, which includes 220. So it's a fine band. But once again, let me just throw it out to the people who had much more experience with 1.2 about the activity in the metropolitan area and whether they have been successful or disappointed by it.
WB2KWC?
Yes, Ken.
Okay, I do not have experience with 1.2, but recently at the Limark board members, board meeting, I'm hearing comments that the ICOM IC9700, which has 1.2, has brought back a lot of interest in the band.
If I may answer that.
Yes, you want to answer that.
The 9700 is a great radio by anybody that's owned one. I have a 7300. I don't know. I didn't, and that's kind of a companion to it. But I just wasn't sure. I wanted to make a $1,400-$1,500 plunge. But Elinco makes a handheld, the DJ7, I believe, that the max on the 1.2 gig is 10 watts. That's what the 9700 has. The Elinco, the max is 1 watt. It's an HT. So I'm not really sure that I could, you know, do anything with 1 watt. So I was just wondering if anybody had any input on that or an experience with it, because I'd rather spend 200 and something bucks than, you know, I'm sure the 9700 is a super radio, but it's a little pricey. Back to you guys.
Okay. Also, I'm thinking back to Kenwood had a very popular radio, the TS2000. I know Wesley owns one. I knew John, KB2KWC, had five of them. There was a version of the TS2000 that was capable of 1.2 gigahertz. So you might want to look through, say, eBay or other places where hams sell off their old equipment, and you might be able to cut yourself a nice deal for something like that.
Thanks very much, Roy. And I want to say 7-3 to everybody. And Roy, thanks for you know, putting up with the craziness sometimes that goes on in these nets. And I'm sure a lot of people that listen, like myself, get frustrated at some of the stuff. But anyway, I'm going to say 7-3, and I'm going to hand this back to the net. I'll ask another question next week.
Okay, very good, Rocco. Thank you for coming. Thank you for participating. Thank you for understanding. You know, we're all trying to have fun here. As I mentioned last week, if you're not having fun, you're doing it terribly, terribly wrong, and you probably should spend your time doing something else. But I try my best, and I appreciate all the people that check in and make this technical net work. You don't want to hear me propound on my theories of the universe every minute of these technical nets. So I like the opportunity of sparing you that. So I thank you, Rocco, and I look forward to next Sunday's question. Yes, what's your first name?
And I just wanted to give a positive vote here. I totally enjoy this net. I enjoy listening to it every time. And so sometimes I know you can get a little controversial sometimes, you know, but that's life. So I just want to say that I'm giving my positive vote. That's all I'm in here for. Thanks. And by the way, the name here is Pete.
Okay, Pete, thank you very much. I appreciate the gesture. Again, I don't want to upset anyone out there. I don't want to hurt anyone's feelings out there. The idea is to inform and entertain people and give them a reason for spending a couple of hours around the repeater. So I thank you for your comments. I hope you'll continue to listen to the Technical Net, and I hope occasionally when something sparks your interest, you'll join in and participate in the conversation.
I'll have more. I have a few technical questions myself, but I'll save them till next time. I think I'll learn a few things listening, and maybe add a few things here and there. So back to you, Roy.
Very good. Well, I mean, I consider a day poorly spent if I don't learn a few things. And very often I learn great things here from my fellow hams who have had different experiences than I have, and they bring to the table new things for me to ponder and consider. It's all good. It's all good. Once again, I'm AC2GS. My name is Roy, and I am net control operator for this, the Limark Technical Net. Limark Technical Net's been going on for 39 and a half years, mostly under the care of Dick K2RIW, who was a great man and a very, very smart man, and we miss him. He became a silent key a year and a half ago, but we are continuing his little baby. He was very proud of it. He would regularly discuss that the Technical Net had done more hours than the Johnny Carson show. So it'll be interesting to see how long we can drag this out. And please, everyone out there, lend a hand and help me do that, just in memory of Dick K2RIW. Anyway, once again, I am AC2GS, and we're still open to any kind of question of a science nature. We got 15 minutes before the SpaceNet report, unless there's no questions or anything going on. But if there are, please give me your first name and your call sign.
Comet, WS2N.
Yes, Paul.
You were talking about the beginnings of the TechNet a while back, so Dick used to keep a weekly count, and you know I continued doing that after he passed away. Anyway, I'm up to 1,870, and of course, he had weeks before in the very beginning. So we don't have an exact date, but you figure anywhere 1985, somewhere in that area. We don't have an exact date, unfortunately. Back to you.
I think it was more than that because he kept on saying that that he had been doing this for 38 years, and that was about 2 years ago.
Yeah, I know, but he was on, with what was his name? Chip? Anyway, I forget his call sign. New Jersey. Anyway, they started, and then he started counting probably years into it. You know how that goes. Let's start counting, and the next thing it was an estimate, and probably off a week here, a week there. You can't figure it exactly, but I remember his numbers. So I just kept adding one for every week since we lost him 2 Marches ago. So. That's it. Back to you.
Yeah, I'm told it was called the Hip and Dick Show, and the guy, the Hip, was for a very long Greek name. He's still operating. He's still in QRZ. He's located, as far as I can tell, in Queens. He had some personal problems that required him to leave the TechNet or Hip and Dick Show or whatever they called it way, way, way back then. It's just, I wish there was someone out there who actually used to listen to the Hip and Dick Show and could give me a rough approximation of when it first began. So I don't know what we could do for the 40th anniversary, but, it would probably be nice to reference it at least when it happens. But you know, we'll see if people out there have a long enough memory.
Okay. And for quite a few years, he was also doing another technical net on Tuesday nights with the Lockfield Amateur Radio Club. I remember that as well, back in the year. Oh, probably in the 1990s or so. So you'd listen to Dick on Sunday night, and then you'd turn on Tuesday night, and you'd hear him again. Sometimes he would ID, you know, you'd forget which club he was talking for. So, you know, that was great. You had this one guy, Lloyd, at WB2ZIT with Lockfield. And he was on. Now he's a silent kid as well. So, very good. Back to you. Just wanted to bring that up. Back to you.
Okay, and I don't want to compare myself to Dick at all, but I actually, this is one of two technical nets that I do. On the second and fourth Wednesday of each month on Brooklyn, KC2RC, I do a technical net. And there was one weird week where Wednesday I did the Kings County Radio Club's technical net. Thursday, I did something called the Fusion Net Technical Net. They wanted to do a technical net as a guest, and so I did that. And then I came in to do the science talk Sunday night with Dick, and I mentioned that I had done three technical nets in about 5 days.
Very good. You won't even know what radio you're on at that point. The science talk, we're up to 197, Roy. So, and let's see, what do we got for the SpaceNet report? I'm up to 470. Back to you.
Ah, very good, very good. I am utterly amazed. If anyone kind of asked me if that would have happened in the future, I would have been confused. Even when Dick kind of, in the good old days, there's always been kind of three legs in this tripod. Paul has always been SpaceNet Report from my memories. Dick was always there. And different people were in the middle someplace, usually mailbag or their own little lesson plan. Mel K2KEY was in that position when I first got my license. Matter of fact, he was a member of Kings County Radio Club that I joined, but unfortunately he had suffered pancreatic cancer and died about a month or two after I joined the club. John, KC2WGB. Unfortunately, I'm phasing out on people's call signs. Took over, and he did the mail bag. And then, unfortunately, John passed away of colon cancer, and the place was empty. And Dick said, "Gee, it would be nice to have someone, you know, do something." So I was going to do the mailbag, except that no one really sends me any mailbag questions. John got loads of them. I know I sent John loads of them myself because I was worried that he didn't get loads of them. But nevertheless, and the first time I was on this technical net, Dick introduced me. Of course, no one knew to send any mailbag questions at the time. And then Dick had to go to the airport to pick up someone. So he kind of left me and Paul to kind of fill the next 2 hours or 2.5 hours or 3 hours. I forget how much. And I just kind of came up with the science talk. And, you know, we did it for a long, long time. Hopefully people enjoyed it when we did it. So that's a little bit of TechNet history, or at least modern TechNet history. I'm sure there's lots of more history. If you ever have a chance, go to KC2NJI's amateurradio.tv. There's archives of the technical net that go as far back as 2006. A lot of good stuff there.
I wish we had tapes from the 80s. Dick was terrific. I remember before getting my license in, what, 86, like a year or two before, I was speaking to a ham, and he says, you've got to listen to this guy. So, you know, get a scanner or something and listen to this guy on Sunday nights. So that goes way back. And it was Dick, K2RIW. Back to you.
Yeah, he was the best-known secret in amateur radio. When I first got my license 10 years ago this past August, I think I joined Kings County Radio Club in September or October. I came to the first meeting, and I asked as many questions as I can, and they told me, you know, by the way, there's this guy over on this other repeater every Saturday night who does technical nets. You might want to take a listen. So I scribbled down the frequency, and I tuned in, and I kept on tuning in. So I certainly thank that. That was Richard KA2KDQ gave me that heads up 10 years ago, and I never looked back. So, yeah, I too wish, you know, there's a lot of things unfortunately lost because people didn't care enough to archive things, and things were much more difficult to archive back in the old days. Nowadays, I'm recording everything. I'm recording this repeater stream. I'm recording about three or four other different audio streams from digital radio and all kinds of things. It's not that difficult. But I remember when I was a kid and I was fascinated with Gene Shepard, who also was an amateur radio operator, but he was a radio personality. I would buy Radio Shack cassettes and record the shows, but I couldn't afford more than X number of cassettes, so I had to reuse them. So all those wonderful shows are lost. Now, if you go out there in the Internet, the people still have archived at least a couple of hundred of his shows, but there are probably thousands of shows that he made. So a lot of things are lost, unfortunately.
AC2PL.
Yes, Jeff.
I just sorry to change the subject. I wanted to quickly ask because I was unable to attend the Limark Tech Fest, Hamfest, which I really wanted to attend. I was wondering if you might just comment on what the coolest thing you saw was today. I know the first one I went to, I thought the coolest thing was the ham sitting there with the service monitor testing the radios that people were buying. It might have even been you. Go ahead, Roy.
No, most likely who you're talking about is our own club's Andy, WA2CDL. He has been a fixture in Hamfest for decades. He has his tune-up table, which you're alluding to. He still has his tune-up table. He's placed on the stage. It was the only real presence on the stage other than the people who were calling out names for the raffles and such. And he's been doing that job gratis for many, 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 many years. You know, he's frequently heard on our technical net, and he promises to come back for Andy's Corner. I actually sat next to him with a table next to him for about a year or two. When I suggested to the president, Richie, K2KNB, if he would like a demonstration of 3D model making. You know, you can make radio knobs and all kinds of bits and pieces that are made out of plastic to replace parts in a radio. So I asked him if there was any interest, and I did that for about four or five Hamfests. It was a nice get-together. It was a shame that we were all kind of unfortunately had to be masked, and very few people ID'd themselves. And so there's at least one person I knew who was there, 2020 hindsight now, that he didn't know I was there. I didn't know he was there. We've never met, so we don't know what either of us looked like, so we weren't able to say hello. But, you know, there were some interesting parts. One gentleman was showing personalized plaques. The vendors were selling their stuff. People were getting rid of their old radio equipment. It was a fun time. To me, it's more of a social get-together than it is a hunt for prizes and such. But it was fun.
AC2PL. Thanks, Ray. I just remember going there and with wide eyes looking at all the cool radios and stuff that were available on the various tables. And some things that you wouldn't have imagined seeing at a ham fest just kind of popped up. Old military stuff, some kind of like handheld spectrum analyzers, just really a lot of very cool things. Anyway, I look forward to going in the years to come without the masks and all that after we've all had our boosters. AC2PL, back to you.
Yes, indeed. I look forward to those times. By the way, have you ever been to Sussex? Sussex is a very interesting ham fest. There's a lot of tables with a lot of equipment.
No, negative. Just a few that I've been to, but Limark was by far and away the best.
Okay, it's Sussex. It's in New Jersey. It's usually every July, and of course Andy has a tune-up table there as well, being Andy. So if you have nothing better to do some future July. It's not that much of a drive. It's not a very local drive, but it's not a long drive. But it's certainly a nice presentation to take in.
Yeah, Roger. I mean, if you can get to Jersey, I guess. But I'll definitely have to think about that. I heard Fairlawn is a fun one as well with the auction. I think they have. Anyway, just spitballing here. Anyway, back to you, Roy. Thanks for holding this net every night and carrying on the tradition. AC2PL, back to net.
You're welcome, Jeff. Well, once again, I am AC2GS, and it's coming up time for the SpaceNet report. So I will leave you with the usual links to ponder and maybe scribble down. If you need to reach me, either to ask a mailbag type question or to bring up some topic that either you'd like to discuss on the next TechNet or you'd just like to hear discussed in general, or if you have a puzzle that you'd like to share with me, then the email address is mailbag@ac2gs.com. If you want to contact Paul, his is spacenetreport@gmail.com. Also, as I mentioned before, if you want to see the link page, and I really think you should take a quick look, if maybe a long look, at Veritasium's presentation on imaginary numbers. It's quite fascinating. That's available on my link page, which is roy.ac2gs.com. And again, if you're interested in picking up an audio stream of the Glen Oaks repeater. I keep it almost 24/7 when the repeater's active. Occasionally I have to reboot the computer, but otherwise, if you have internet access but not any radio access, just type into your browser technet.ac2gs.com, and that'll bring you my audio stream. And as always, I like to remind people of my KC2NJI's wonderful archive site, amateurradio.tv, has archives of the Limark Technical Net that go as far back as September 2006. And he's had a million visitors, so make it a million and one. Again, his address is amateurradio.tv. So keep those all in mind. Again, want to thank everyone who participated tonight. Again, I hope that you learned something. I hope you had a little fun. I hope you'll join us again next Sunday when we try and do it all over again. So with no further ado, I will call upon Paul, WS2N, with the SpaceNet report.
AC2GS, WS2N, thanks, Roy. And the next
big event anyway for us would be HRO, right? Ham Radio University. That'll be in January. I'll have to try to find a date on that. But that's always very good. Last year, of course, COVID knocked out the in-person HRO. I think they had the virtual this way. I'll definitely make that one, Roy.
Paul?
Yes?
My understanding is that it's going to be virtual again come January.
Oh, I hope not. Okay. I didn't know that. Wow. Okay. We'll keep that in mind. Maybe they'll change it. Although I do see the numbers ticking up. Every day I look at those numbers, the COVID numbers, and on the average it looks like it's been ticking up for the last couple of weeks.
Yeah, I tend to think they locked it down because if you look at the website, they don't do any ifs, ands, or buts. They say they're going to be using web experience as the means. They've even scheduled people who do presentations over a web-based environment. So at least for this coming January, it's going to be web-based. I don't know about the future. Perhaps at some point they'll share with us whether they're thinking in terms of returning to the old model or sticking with the new one that they've recently discovered.
Okay, understood. And anybody that's new to Ham Radio University is really very good. I went to the first one, I guess, 20 years ago. But I think it was 19, maybe longer than that. I thought it was 1999. I don't know, I'll have to check. But roughly 20 years ago. And they had a different location. Now it's CW Post College. Okay, we'll watch for that virtual HRO anyway. Thanks for that, Roy. Anyway, over to the SpaceNet report for this week's TechNet. I'll start off with actually bad news. You remember a month or so ago, Blue Origin launched four people into space on their new Shepard vehicle. And that's the one that made all the news with William Shatner being on board. And he had three other people with him, Audrey Powers. She's like an executive for Blue Origin. And then you had this fellow, Chris Bajan, I think it is Bajan. Anyway, he's a co-founder of Planet Labs, which launches satellites on a regular basis. I think they got probably about 50 of them up there now. They have cameras and they take pictures of the Earth and extremely high resolution pictures. And then there was this other fella, Glenn DeVries, and he's a co-founder of something called, I think it was Media Data Solutions. And unfortunately, I think, two or three days ago, he's flying an airplane with an instructor, and they went down in New Jersey. So unfortunately, he did not survive the crash. But you know, you never know. A month or so ago, he's on TV getting launched into suborbital space on Blue Origin's new Shepard, and the next thing you know, he's deceased, which is a real shame. Anyway, we'll move on from that topic, but unfortunately that's very bad news. Our condolences go out to his family. Any comments? WS1. Okay. As far as
launches and landings. We have the crew, they call it Crew 3, launched by SpaceX to the International Space Station. That went up Wednesday morning. They launched from Launch Complex 39A in Florida, and four people on board. And they successfully spent a day or so in space and then docked with the International Space Station. They have four of our astronauts on board, and this time they all have ham radio license, which is 100% of the crew are hams. Raja Chare is the commander, KI5L, LIU, Tom Washburn, he was the pilot, KE5HOC, Kayla Barron, KI5LAL, she's from Idaho, and you have a European Space Agency fellow from Germany, Matthias Meyer, KI5KFH. They successfully went up in the Dragon crew vehicle, launched on the Falcon 9 rocket, and they had no problems. Everything seems to be working this time. It's a brand new spacecraft. SpaceX now has three of these crew vehicles that they could launch, and they have a fourth one in the working. The next crew that goes up roughly 6 months from now will also be flying a new vehicle. So what was supposed to happen, they had seven people on board, and they're going to replace four other people. The other four were going to stay on board. The other four usually would dock with the space station, and then they would get more or less a tour. And you'd have 11 people on board the space station for a couple of days, and then the other crew that's been up there for 6 months would return. But because of a couple of delays, weather delays, one of the crew members was sick, they delayed the flight because of that. The other crew came back, Anton Shapovalov, Pyro Dubov, and Mark Van Hyl were on board. They're still up there. But the other four came back, Shane Kimbrough, also a ham, KE5HOD. Megan MacArthur, no call sign, but she's married to a ham that went up recently on the first crew vehicle, who is a ham. And Thomas Pesquet from he's another ham, KG5FYG, and then Kisho Hoside, he's from Japan, KE5DNI. They returned successfully, came back, and instead of landing in the Atlantic Ocean, they landed them near Florida, near Pensacola, Florida. Successful splashdown. It was dark, but I did get a chance to see it on TV. SpaceX has a boat that goes out, all kinds of hydraulics and everything, a lift on it, and it pulls the whole spacecraft right into the boat, and they put it into what they call the nest. And then at that point, when they're ready, they open up the door and they can get the whole crew out. So they were up there for 6 months. So they've now sent three different crews to the internet. Well, let's see, one, two, actually, four different crews. The first one just had two people in it, and then they had that was an experimental one. So the second one was four people. They call that crew one. Another one was four, crew two, and then this one is crew three. And they're launching a lot of people into space. So about month ago they launched the Inspiration mission, which had nothing to do with NASA. That was four people they just launched into space, did not dock with the space station, spent 3 days in space and came back and returned. That crew landed in the Atlantic Ocean. So they're getting into a bit of a rhythm, and before you know it, it's going to be almost impossible to keep track of all the different launches and landings that's going on, especially now if Boeing gets their Starliner working. But I don't expect them to get a launch until maybe the fall will be the first time they could launch a crew on a Starliner. And they'll start off by launching three people, and eventually they'll be launching four people at a time. So that, you know, that Starliner is made by Boeing. And they've had a lot of problems recently with their valves. The valves were getting stuck in the open position, and they would not close. And they are working that problem. It's taking many, many months to fix. So that's the story with the manned missions to and from the space station. Before I move on to the story of Ingenuity, let me see if anybody has any comments or questions. Okay, Ingenuity is the helicopter that's been flying on Mars, brought up by the Perseverance rover. Was brought up on the belly of that rover, which successfully landed February 18th of this year. And since then, it's released the grip on the helicopter. Helicopter put itself into operation, opened up its four legs. It's got two blades on top. They spin one spins clockwise, the other one counterclockwise, and they were hoping to get no more than five flights out of that helicopter. They named the helicopter Ingenuity, and sure enough, one after the other, each one going further, each one going higher. They thought maybe originally 15 feet high. This last one they just did, it went 40 feet high. It flew probably the distance of three football fields. Been going faster. They got real confident on flying this thing. Naturally, they pre-program it before it flies. And, you know, the clock ticks down, the thing takes off, it does its mission, takes pictures, and eventually comes back down and lands without hitting anything. It has, a camera, it can see where it's going when it's landing. And they hope for five flights. Now they're up to 14. They've just completed their 14th flight. Ingenuity is, they've even changed the way the system works. They're able to adjust the speed of the blades. When they first went up there, it was on the cold side on Mars, and when it's colder up there, you have more moisture in the air at the time. And then, when it gets colder, the moisture drops out of the air. You have carbon dioxide. Anyway, it's less dense now that they're moving into summertime. The blades are able to, have to be able to spin faster. These things spin at like 2,500 RPM. But now they have to spin it because the air is thinner at 2,700 RPM. So that's really moving. They say a regular helicopter here on Earth, I think it's 300 or 400 RPM. These things are 2,500 or more. But because of the thinner atmosphere, as the months went on, they were able to up the speed of the blades, which compensates for the thinner atmosphere. I mean, the atmosphere is thin already. It's like 1% of what we have here on Earth. You know, we have like one bar here, or the equivalent of 14.7 pounds per square inch. This thing is less than, on Mars, it's less than 1/100th of a bar. So they say it's equivalent to flying at maybe three times the height of Mount Everest, or say 75,000 feet or so. The air is pretty rarefied at that height. But yet this thing is doing it, and very successful. Now they plan on flying not five, but maybe up to seven, at least seven more flights. As the rover is traveling around this gigantic circle, the rover is going out ahead of it, taking pictures. It's actually become operational. Instead of an experimental thing, this thing is operational. It's now taking pictures and giving the people at JPL that operate the rover more of a heads up of what's ahead, and they could navigate the Perseverance rover a lot better using Ingenuity's helicopter. And they plan on flying it up to maybe seven more times, and after five or seven more times, it will be back to the original landing spot where it took off from. And where they go from there, I don't know. But, that's the ultimate goal right now. Ingenuity. Here's this little thing. I mean, the box part of it is maybe about, you know, I think it's around five inch cube with these big 3.5 foot long blades on top. Spinning opposite one another. Actually, they have separate motors and everything. I think it's like seven different motors, you know, two main motors for the helicopter's blades, and then other motors to, you know, work actuators to change the pitch and everything on where this thing goes. They could rotate it, and, you know, you can go up, and they can actually rotate it 90 degrees if they want. Very good control. So 14 different flights. Now, talk about reusability. Elon Musk and SpaceX, you know, have made that a mainstay of their whole operations, reusability. Well, NASA really hasn't been really left behind yet. They talk about the latest rockets are not going to be reusable. But here's a helicopter flying on Mars, you know, anywhere between 30 and 130 million miles away from Earth, being used over and over again. So I think that's pretty amazing. The rovers themselves going not weeks, not months, but, you know, in some cases years. We had that solar-powered rover Opportunity that lasted 14 years. Curiosity is still up there riding around with its nuclear-powered system, and that's been up there since 2012. So before you know it, that thing will be 10 years old. And of course, now Perseverance, you know, that's a baby, and that's only up there for 10 months now. WS2N. Any comments or questions? I left enough time for any Echo Link people if they're on. I know Roy would know if say Frank is on. But okay, let's see, we're in November. Next month, I believe it's the 18th, we have the planned launch of the James Webb Space Telescope, which I've talked about endlessly. But that will be going to the L2 position, 1 million miles away from Earth, and stay there virtually forever. And that will be looking out away from Earth year after year with its 21-foot diameter dish. And on the opposite side, you have these five layers of protection for heat. Mylar blankets the size of a tennis court separating the telescope from the direct rays of the sun. And on the hot side, the side facing the sun, you have communications and communication antennas working on the X-band, pointing back to the deep space network on Earth. And you have your solar panel, you have one big solar panel that will be able to keep this thing going. Hopefully, they said minimum 5 years. They're hoping for 10 years for the James Webb Space Telescope. And then there's another big panel, and that's able to actually move around a little bit, and that faces the sun as well, but not to pick up solar radiation for solar panel, but they actually use it for moving the spacecraft ever so slightly. They'll be able to use the solar wind to actually push the spacecraft one way or another if they want. Yeah, anything to save fuel. Yeah, it will have a lot of hydrazine fuel on board. It does have thrusters, so it will be able to move once in a while in a tail orbit if need be. Once in a while, you do have to do that. It's a perfect orbit where you really don't need to use any energy to keep it where it is, except once in a while it might drift a little bit and. And they will have that capability to use those hydrazine thrusters if need be. Now this thing has been in the works. They've been building it for like 10 years. They've been thinking about it since after Hubble went up in the 1990s. They used to call James Webb Space Telescope the next generation telescope. Then finally it got a name, and then it got plenty of money. It started off, well, maybe $500 million, or maybe $1 billion. Next thing you know, it was up to $8 billion. I remember talking to Dick about that at one of the Limark ham fairs, talking about the cost of this thing, and he said, what, $8 billion? Well, yeah, that's what it was some years ago. Now it's $10.5 billion. And so the price really went up. And anyway, it will be good to see this thing actually taking pictures. Once it's located where it is, which will take roughly a month to get to that location, it goes out very fast on a Ariane 5 rocket from Kourou, French Guiana, but then eventually starts slowing down little by little as it's going out until it gets a million miles out, roughly four times the distance of the orbit of the moon, until it eventually comes to almost a grinding stop. And then, after that, you've got another 4 months or so of calibration. So after launch, you're looking at roughly 5 months or so before you actually get to what they call first light. First, be able to see if this big gamble really pays off. I mean, it looks good. I mean, they've tested this thing endlessly, from what I've read over the years. I think it's something like over 80 different pyrotechnic devices have to ignite. When they ignite, it pushes a piston. The piston has this guillotine type of thing on the end of it. It cuts cables, does different things. Springs start moving, opening up. There's motors to be turned on to unfurl this thing from you know, from a location inside the fairing of the rocket to eventually this thing the size of a tennis court with a mirror 21 feet in diameter. So there's other telescopes that are planned that are going to be going up that are presently funded. There's one telescope now that it's really not funded yet. I think there's some preliminary money that has been involved in putting this thing together. But it's going to need congressional approval. And anyway, it's going to be called the Large Ultraviolet Optical Infrared Survey Telescope. This thing, you know, as big as James Webb Space Telescope is compared to the Hubble, which is almost like three times the size. Hubble has an 8-foot diameter mirror, a little bit less than that. James Webb is 21 feet in diameter. This new one, they expect to be about three times that size. So this massive telescope. It sort of looks like James Webb, except much bigger. It's got a protective sun shield as well. And the difference is the size of it is going to be, about three times the size of the diameter of the James Webb Space Telescope. I read it was 16 meters, so let's call it like 53 feet, something like that. 53 feet in diameter compared to James Webb at 21 feet. So I'm sure they'll be able to really see back to the beginning of time with that thing. And it's going to cover a larger bandwidth, but in the world of optics anyway, it's going to be able to cover a larger amount of nanometers that it could see. I think they said three or four times whatever James Webb is. So we'll see. They'll be in the ultraviolet, they'll be in the infrared, all of that. Now they just have to fund it. And how much is this thing going to cost? Maybe they'll make it the same price. You know, they'll have the experience with James Webb Space Telescope. Who knows? Any comments, questions? WS2N. Okay, another rocket that will be going up, I believe, this week. I saw the 14th, but today's the 14th, and I didn't hear that it went up yet, is this rocket made by Astra. Astra has been launching rockets from Alaska, the Kodiak launch complex, I think they call it now, the Pacific Kodiak launch complex. But anyway, they launch rockets from Alaska, you know, for the last 10, 20 years. Every once in a while, another company will try launching something. They've launched military test rockets from Alaska. And this company, Astra, is testing their rocket. They've launched three times, and each time they get a little bit better with their rocket. It's only about like a 40, 45-foot tall rocket. It's not that big. Actually, the diameter is not all that big either. But it is kerosene, liquid oxygen rocket. And very inexpensive. They think to get satellites in space, naturally small satellites, will be in a $2.5 million launch price range. You compare that to SpaceX, they always say their Falcon 9 is $62 million to launch. Now, truly, this will, you know, they'll be able to launch maybe 2, 3, 4, 5 satellites at a time, compared to SpaceX launching, you know, 50 or 60 satellites at a time, each one weighing 500 pounds. But still, this company, you know, is gung-ho. I think they might make it next time. They got very, very close last time. You know, they got their first stage went, and they had some problems at the very end. So, you know, they had to self-destruct the rocket. This rocket, if it makes it, they'll be very happy about it, and they plan on launching thousands of these rockets if this thing is successful. They plan on building their own broadband system, similar to what SpaceX has been doing. They've been putting up satellite after satellite. I think they have over 1,800 satellites now for SpaceX operating, you know, for broadband. Now this company wants to do the same thing, manufacture their own satellites, broadband satellites, and launch them with their rockets. But we'll see. They don't have a fancy name for their rocket. It's called Rocket 3.3. But we'll see how they do. I hope they make it. They have these Delphi engines. I believe there's five of them for the first stage and one for the second stage. And they have a very similar setup to the Electron rocket that's being launched by Rocket Lab. Rocket Lab launches out of the North Island of New Zealand, and eventually they plan on launching out of Virginia, out of Wallops Island. They already have their launch pad built there, ready to go. And they have a system where the turbo pumps that spin, you need turbo pumps to take a tremendous amount of fuel and oxidizer and in liquid form and force it into the rocket's chamber. And you need something to spin these turbos, and most of the times they use the exhaust from the the engine itself, or they'll use pre-burners, they call them, which are like little rocket engines, which take the thrust of that to spin up these turbos. Some companies, like Boeing, with the Atlas rocket, to spin their first stage engine up, they use nitrogen, and the nitrogen is actually on the ground in a tank, and they have it piped into the first stage to spin it up, and that's how it gets started. And then once it launches, then the exhaust from the engines keep those turbos running. What Rocket Lab has done with the Electron rocket, and now with this company with the Astra rocket is doing with their Delphi engine, is instead of using any kind of exhaust or anything like that, or nitrogen, you know, being fed from the ground, what they use is electric motors that are being spun up by they use their lithium-ion batteries to spin up these turbos, and each engine has its own motor, has its own battery, and that's it. These things spin up with that, so they have the same kind of design as Rocket Lab. Rocket Lab is very, very successful. I think they're probably up to about 18 or so launches, and that's how they plan on getting into space. It's weird because, I mean, these things are not planned on ever being reusable. So as far as Astra is concerned, first stage goes up. Every stage that goes up, you're throwing away five motors and at least five lithium-ion batteries. Rocket Lab, originally that was their plan too, just to have everyone go into the ocean. But now they plan on having reusability for their boosters as well. they have a launch coming up very shortly, and they plan on reusing those boosters as well. I think they've already landed three of them in the water. They just land them in the water. They come down on a parachute, and then they pick them up and they bring them back. But I don't believe they've actually reused one of those boosters yet. Their ultimate goal is to have it coming down on a parachute, have a helicopter fly out with this hook, and they plan on catching this cable that's going to be flying right near the top of the parachute, grab it with a hook, and then have the helicopter fly the booster to a ship, land on the ship, and then have the ship float it all the way back to headquarters in New Zealand. And for us, when they fly out of Virginia, they'll bring it back to Virginia, and then refurbish the booster and launch it again. That sounds great if they do that. Any comments? WS2X. Okay. I remember Dick used to talk about the Hubble Space Telescope all the time, and he was what you call a Hubble hugger, and he wanted this thing to run forever, and sure enough, it's pretty much been doing that since 1990 from its launch. It took them, what, 2.5 years before they could send a crew up to service the first one and put it into operation and get its corrected vision back, because they had sent it up with a mirror that was not cut to the proper design that they wanted to, or that they should have done, and they corrected it with corrective optics, and it's been great ever since. They've serviced it a total of 5 service flights using the space shuttle. Have gone up to service it over the years. They've changed everything out from computers to batteries to gyroscopes to actual changing out the solar panels themselves, throwing them away, putting new ones on. And the last one was 2009 was the last service mission. But this year they've had some problems with it. Certain parts have failed, and they've done a couple of workarounds to get it back up working again, which they did. And one time it was shut down for like 6 weeks, and they finally got it running again, doing different, switching to a different backup computer or whatever they did. And now it just failed again about 2 weeks ago. It was out for about a week, and from last I heard, it's now back into operation again. And for some reason, they believe this thing is going to keep running until the end of the decade. I hope it does, but I don't know. That seems very optimistic to me. I know the scientists would love to at least have it running when James Webb Space Telescope gets put into orbit in December and in operation, probably in May of next year. And they would like to be able to take pictures of the same something or other, a galaxy or whatever it might be, black hole, and have a side-by-side picture, which I think would be great. Hopefully they're able to accomplish that. So that's the story on Hubble. We hope it keeps going, because that was just one fantastic machine that they put up there. Any comments? Okay, here's a company that we talked about a couple of years ago, maybe 3-4 years ago when they first came up with this idea. The name of the company is called Spin Launch. Spin Launch has this idea that you could take a rocket and put in this centrifugal concrete device and spin this rocket up inside so fast, and it'll, at the right nanosecond, release it, and the thing's going to take off and be flung into outer space. They expect to get this thing up to like maybe 4,000 miles an hour. Now, if they could do that, they would be able to drive the cost of launching a satellite into space by a tremendous amount. I just have my doubts with the system. I think the amount of G-forces that are going to be created inside this spinning contraption is going to be so great. But apparently, you know, somebody must have did the math on it. I know you're not going to launch humans, but you know, even machinery doesn't want to, you know, electronics don't want to be exerted to a certain, you know, high G's. And that's what would have to happen with this. Anyway, they built this thing. I think it's around 100 feet tall out in New Mexico to spin this thing up. This is a test version of what they wanted to do. And they set up in Spaceport America. Spaceport America is located in New Mexico. The taxpayer out there paid for building this thing maybe 15, 20 years ago. They wanted to do it, and they were having trouble getting companies to go there. They thought that the space programs would be, you know, accelerated by you know, a lot by now. But now they are starting to get business out there. And right now, Virgin Galactic now has their headquarters now at Spaceport America. And so does
that time
companies.
Complete.
Spin launch company. So they tested something last week. I think it was a couple hundred pounds. They spun it up inside this machine and let it go. There is no video of it. I can't find a YouTube or anything on it. I did find a picture of what this thing looks like standing out in the desert. And it stands vertically. In other words, if you be able to take a record, an LP, and put it, you know, 90 degrees vertically, it's in that configuration. And then it's apparently spun this thing up and released it. You know, it's like, to me, it's like a Wile E. Coyote type of thing. I can picture that cartoon with him, you know, trying to get himself launched to try to get away from Roadrunner. You know, spinning around in something like this and releasing himself. That's what this thing reminds me of, with him sitting on the end of a you know, a missile. But we'll see. Now, the company says they need to build another one. This was like a test. It went up. They didn't say exactly how high. They said thousands of feet. But you know, you need to get this thing up to like 50 miles. So you're going to need a bigger one of these things. So they plan on building a bigger one. They've got all kinds of investors coming in, throwing money at this company, which I really don't get. Again, the G-forces must be tremendous. You take something, I think this thing was probably, I don't know, maybe 80 feet or so in diameter, I guess. I can't tell from the picture. But, you know, make it 300 feet and spin this thing up. I guess I could do the math, figure out what the G's are going to be on a certain amount of RPMs. Problem is, I don't know what the RPMs would have to be. I guess this will eventually all come out. But we'll see. Anyway, I'll keep my eye on spin launch and see what happens in the future. Any comments or questions? WSY. Okay, we're getting to the top of the hour, and I've gone on enough. A couple more topics, but we could always save them for next week. I'm going to turn it back to Roy. Before I do, anybody that's listening, can check into the Limark Club InfoNet, which is tomorrow night at 8:30 on these repeaters. And you don't have to be a member to do that. You can find out what the club is up to. And they always welcome check-ins. That's always followed by Swap and Shop, and then also followed by Newsline. Roy, over to you, AC2GS. This is WS2N. Put a space that report for the TechNet.
Well, Paul, thank you very much. Thank you for the SpaceNet report. Thank you for all the work that you